So, hello, I'm here with PPK. He just gave his tech talk on mobile browsers, and we're going to chat a bit about some of the problems that he encountered, some of the things that he's thinking about nowadays. It seems like you're concentrating on mobile browsers right now when it comes to your research. You've been doing research for desktop browsers for years and years, and we all looked at the compatibility tables. In terms of the advent of the mobile web, looking at the bugs that we have right now, what kind of work is coming towards us?
The first really important part is finding out what actually goes wrong in browsers. The second part is figuring out which bugs are just too complicated to solve. And I think we just should try to, just start trying stuff. Because right now I don't have a general overview of where all the browsers are heading on the mobile. Basically, we can see that as a slight convergence toward web standards. All mobile browsers, or modern mobile browsers, I should say, do support web standards, so that's good. Only their exact level of support differs, of course.
Mm-hmm. My problem with some of these things is that I'm getting bored of browsers doing the wrong thing. That's why I'm an advocate of saying, if you start something new nowadays for the desktop market, start working with a library. Because libraries are there to work around browser issues, and all the obscure bugs that you find are actually trapped in there, especially when it comes to JavaScript, not necessarily with CSS frameworks. Do you agree, or do you still think it makes more sense to plow through it yourself?
I agree in so far that it seems that most of the mobile browser bugs are covered by the JavaScript libraries, but first we have to figure out how JavaScript libraries work in terms of performance on the mobile level, because that's one of the problems we're having right now. JavaScript libraries are all fine and good, but they're also rather large, and if you use just one little JavaScript library, it won't be much of a problem, but part of the problem might be using large JavaScript libraries or using several JavaScript libraries on one page. You shouldn't do that, but it still happens. And besides, we have to figure out which one works best in terms of performance. That's the first step we have to take. In general, I totally agree that we should use JavaScript libraries in order to work around browser problems. But the point is, on the mobile web, first of all, there are other browser problems, because there are other browsers. There's the BlackBerry and NetFront browsers that just do not exist on desktop. And besides, there may be device problems, say memory problems in some device. Some devices will have a far smaller work memory for the browser than others, etc., etc. So although I agree in principle, there's lots of research to be done.
I was talking about desktop market. I didn't even gather yet that JavaScript libraries are ready for the mobile market. I think it might even be more interesting to come up with a library for the mobile market once your research has been done.
Yes, I think so. Well, a part of the research is just include a JavaScript library in your page and just try it on mobile browsers. I mean, I haven't tried it yet, but it could very well be that most of the libraries will actually work well on mobile browsers. To get back to the desktop browsers, yes, I totally agree, you should use a JavaScript library, except that that rule doesn't go for me, because I do not use a JavaScript library.
Well, the problem I see with that, and I found myself doing that as well, is I always think, yeah, I know this stuff, I write my library, but then a new browser comes around the corner, and out of a sudden I have to revisit all my old implementations and fix them. Which, of course, I don't do because I'm already bored with the old implementation and want to do something new, and this is how developers work. Do you think there is a way around that? Is there any chance that sooner or later we're not going to listen to that little feature creature on our shoulder that keeps telling us we have to do it ourselves because using a library is just not manly enough?
Yeah, I think so. Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I'm not using a JavaScript library myself, mainly because I do not do production work anymore, and because part of my job is to actually figure out what works in browsers and what doesn't in order to enable the next generation of JavaScript libraries. So, but in general, I totally agree with you that we should choose JavaScript libraries. The only question is which one exactly do we use, and is there a better JavaScript library for a certain task?
What really fascinates me and is the discussion on the web development and web design front about like embedding fonts into the website, because, oh my God, we don't have enough nice fonts. Your research found that in mobile phones that's even worse, because sometimes even the variations of a font like the italic or the small caps is not available for you. What are your ideas of font embedding and CIFR and QFON or whatever else we might do at the moment?
Well, it's obviously a good idea. I mean, designers want to use extra fonts, so let's by all means give them the opportunity. As far as I'm concerned, it's mostly a technical issue. Will the new add font phase work in all browsers? If so, will it work only with certain fonts, with all fonts? Copyright stuff. I hate copyright stuff, so I don't bother with that too much, but it's a problem that should be solved. So I think it's mostly an implementation problem right now. As to the mobile web, it's far worse. Because A, I have no idea if you can actually download and install a font on a mobile phone. I've never tried it. And B, there will be less memory, there will be other problems. There are several operating systems out of the on the mobile web that aren't on the desktop, so they will probably treat fonts differently, etc., etc., etc. So I think that in principle we found a way forward, but we have a lot of technical implementation details to solve.
One of my main problems when I looked at what you've done and I listened to the other talks that you've given seems to be that testing for mobile phone is a pain unless you have like 5,000 SIM cards at your disposal and you actually can restart your mobile phone really fast. What were the main problems that you find during testing and where do you find the patients?
Well, the patients I find through being paid. That's a very important topic for me. As to testing on mobile phones, yes, it is a pain. Fortunately, about half of the phones I test support Wi-Fi, so I can just use my local Wi-Fi network at home. The other half need a SIM card. I've got exactly one SIM card from Vodafone because you actually have to pay for that. And so basically, the trick is knowing when to switch your SIM card. Most mobile phones actually start up pretty quickly. The main exception is the BlackBerry. If I want to test a BlackBerry, which does not have Wi-Fi, then I basically have to insert the SIM card 5 minutes before I actually want to test the BlackBerry. So basically, what I'm trying to do now is insert SIM card into BlackBerry, go to, play with a few phones that support Wi-Fi, then come back to the BlackBerry. And this is going to be a problem, yes. It's going to remain a problem for a while. But still, more and more phones are going to support Wi-Fi, and that really helps a lot.
Well, it's an interesting aspect, though. Like, I found, for example, on a desktop, when I do user testing or when I test my applications, that cutting down on a slower connection, like going, for example, with Sloppy, that Java proxy, to go down a simulated 56K connection, makes me find bugs that are just not happening in the normal speed. So there might be a difference between testing on Wi-Fi and testing on a GSM connection.
Oh, okay. I've never found that problem, but frankly, I never compared Wi-Fi tests with GSM tests. So I have to look into this.
Because in terms of like implementation, when you're out in the field and you're actually trying to find the bus or the train information on your mobile phone, that's when it gets interesting. Mm-hmm. Then again, GSM speeds are rather high, but we're in England as well, let's face it. Not necessarily in every country that way. In terms of rendering speeds and issues, you said that most browsers nowadays do support DOM to a certain degree. Do you have the same rebranding or like reflowing issues that you have in Opera, for example, on a desktop? Are there differences from handset to handset as to what you can use in terms of dynamic changing of interface elements?
In theory, you can use everything, but some browsers have lousy performance. Basically, that's the main difference with desktop. On desktop, all browsers now perform reasonably well. But on mobile, there are several browsers that do not perform well at all. I did a very simple test. I appended 5,000 LIs to a document and I measured the time the browser needed. The fastest browser by far was the S60 WebKit with about 5.5 seconds. And the BlackBerry and IE and NetFront were so slow that they basically never woke up. And I couldn't establish how long it took to implement 5,000 LIs in a document. So basically, we are again looking at performance problems. In general, the mobile browsers support DOM slightly worse than the desktop browsers, not even much worse, but remember, I'm doing atomic tests. I'm just testing, does this single method, a property, work in this browser, yes or no? And usually it's yes, but the real problems come when you want to create a script that does something really heavy when you run into performance problems.
That's my big bugbear with all the different performance testing. I mean, writing for Ajaxi, and you always have these size comparison charts, which is, to me, it seems juvenile. like injecting 5,000 LIs into a document. Yes, this shows you how fast the rendering engine goes, but in a real DOM scripting, you would do other things. You would create elements in between, you would inject HTML into them, you would write them out. It seems to be an academic test. Like, why would I test for something that people never ever do? Why not just use, for example, an out-of-the-box thing like like, for example, a light box or an image carousel that everybody uses and test them across the different platforms, because that would give us information that people can immediately learn from.
That's true, and I'd love to do these tests. The point is that you have to start somewhere, and basically I want to start somewhere with a very simple script that I write. And besides, I also want to make sure that the tests I do a lot of things, and they take a while, because that will allow subtle differences between browsers to creep up. For instance, it might be interesting to know that a certain browser takes 7 seconds to append 5,000 LI, while another takes 5.5 seconds. I mean, these could be the differences that are important to implementers. Once we've done such simple tests, I think we should do more complicated tests. I did try to run one of the tests of the Dojo guys. I forget the name of it right now. But the problem was that they basically imported all libraries into one
single... SlickSpeed.
Yes, it was SlickSpeed. That's correct. They tried to... tried to import all JavaScript libraries into one single document and then run some tests, and that was just way too heavy for a mobile phone. So basically, if we're looking at pure speed tests, I think that the common speed test for the desktop browser is too heavy for mobile phones. Excuse me. Possibly in terms of performance, but certainly in terms of memory use.
Well, I also... When I hear the SlickSpeed test and I see that we implement all JavaScript pages in one document, that already, to me, changes the outcome of that test, because the libraries will actually interfere with each other. Even if they run in different iframes, they all go into the same thing, because we don't have multi-threaded browsers yet. So if you wanted to test them against different speed, you would have to do it in a Browser Plus or in a Google Gears environment, where you can run a thread for each of the libraries. Because otherwise, this is... I mean, I don't trust browsers. They're bastards. They lie to you all the time.
Absolutely.
So we spend so much time comparing each other's sizes and speeds, but it's never in a production environment. I found the best way to test something in terms of speed on your interface is put like 4 or 5 different ads on that page with the terrible code that comes with ad providers and then the different different servers that they call in between. And you find amazing mistakes that or bugs that you hadn't thought of.
Could be, yeah. Let's do the test, by all means.
You said that Vodafone gave you one SIM card, which is good. Have you thought of, or is there an opportunity that you could ask other providers to actually jump onto that ship and give you more of their cards, or maybe some of their headsets that actually build for their market, like 3 or... T-Online or somebody?
In theory, yes. The only point is that I'm not in touch with the other providers. But in theory, that could definitely be possible, because in theory, it could be that there's a difference between, for instance, the Vodafone and the T-Mobile networks, just as there is a difference between the Vodafone and the Wi-Fi networks or whatever. The point is that there are so many variables right now that I'm just happy that I can present some conclusions at all. And I mean, what I presented just now just gave a kind of hierarchy of browsers. There are some browsers that are very good, others are very bad. I don't think that creating much more complicated tests will change that basic idea. It's just that we'll find many more browser bugs, of course. As far as I can see now, the bugs are... There are some bugs in CSS. There are not so many bugs in the atomic DOM tests I do, but again, that is not in a real-world environment. It's just clicking on a single link and making sure that this or that property or method works in this browser. I think that the real problems will come when we use a lot of memory, when performance becomes an issue, and when we test in a real-world environment. Basically, what we need is, what I personally would like to have, is a list of tests I could do that other people have written and that are more real-world. And I can just go there with the mobile phone, click on the tests, take a note of how long it takes, etc., etc.
Well, it's set up a wiki.
Yeah, something like that. Something like that.
WebKit aficionados actually always go nuts about the cool transitions you can do with it, and there's not a week where there is not some blog post to show people that we can have text on a cube right now, which makes it completely unreadable,
mm-hmm.
But great to look
yes,
at, and we really use that. So how do these transformations, and especially the CSS animations, work across different mobile devices?
I haven't tested it yet.
Because a lot of people say this is like, oh, this is so much better because it's much faster than any JavaScript animation that you will ever do.
That is, I think, true in principle, but I just haven't tested it yet. What I do know, and it's somewhat related, is that when you want to reflow a page because, for instance, the user has tilted the mobile phone from vertical to horizontal orientation, you could do that by JavaScript, of course, or you could use media queries. And I do know that media queries are far faster in Opera than JavaScript. So basically the whole idea of CSS transformations is make the transformations and the animations internal to the browser so that in theory they'll run faster. And as far as I can see right now, that is indeed happening.
Yeah, because it's happening natively in the browser code rather than going through a Java engine first.
Exactly.
The upside of using JavaScript for these kind of things is, of course, that you have control. You can read the frames per second, you know where you are in the animation, you know if it successfully ended, and you can fire an event. That's something that CSS does not have yet. And I'm wary of CSS going that way, because for some reason I think we turn CSS into JavaScript now.
Yeah, that's a tricky subject. When Apple started with WebKit transformation and animation, I thought exactly the same as you. This is a job for JavaScript and not for CSS. Meanwhile, we found out that it works faster and smoother in CSS, which is one advantage. The other advantage, I think, is let them try it. Let them just try anything new in CSS that they want, and eventually we'll figure out whether it's a good or a bad idea. Basically, it's innovation. The browsers, and especially Apple, are now innovating like hell in CSS. And I say just let them. The only thing is if you have an innovation and it turns out not to work too well, or it turns out that another innovation is becoming the web standard, then you should gracefully give in and implement the web standard after all. As long as you do that, I have no problem with Apple trying it.
It's one of the things that cracks me up about being an Apple fan myself, just because the hardware works, not because necessarily it's the prettiest or I have to have it. If Apple innovates in the CSS space, everybody applauds. If Microsoft comes up with colored scroll bars, everybody was proclaiming and shouting that that's not a standard.
Yeah. It's basically the old Microsoft is evil meme. I mean, Microsoft used to be evil, but they restarted working on IE, 3-4 years ago, and that conclusively shows that they are not evil, because why do they want to start working on IE again? In order to implement web standards. And it's as simple as that. Sure, they haven't gotten there yet. Sure, IE8 is still behind the other browsers, but they are doing their best, and they're getting somewhere. The only question now is, will IE improve faster than the other browsers, so that IE will eventually take up on the other browsers?
Do you see that happening? Because now they support CSS2, whereas others are thinking about CSS3.
Yes. Basically, what they've elected to do is make sure that their basics work, which means CSS2. And now we have to see huge improvements in DOM scripting, especially in the events model and in CSS3.
Yeah, the speed of the JavaScript engine as well, because that one hasn't been changed in IE8 yet.
I think it has, but I'm not sure.
Would be necessary.
But that's one of the points right now, that everybody's focusing on performance so much, which is good in itself, but they're tending to forget a bit about new DOM implementations. And I especially think, for instance, in Firefox, Firefox still doesn't support the contains method, which is totally useful in certain situations, where you can figure out whether element A contains element B. I mean, it's very simple to implement, and Firefox still doesn't support it. So those are my pet peeves with Firefox, and I've got a few with Opera and Safari here too.
Yeah, talking to somebody working for a company and with the department that talks about speed and page performance a lot, Google just released their page speed implementation, which is much like YSLO, but it's more open currently. And I looked at their documentation, and I was very vocal on the mailing list as well, and pointed out some of the examples were absolutely terrible in terms of JavaScript performance, and they were a replacement for CSS Hover. Mm. So the statement was that CSS Hover is always slow on elements that are not links and just diffs and things like that, and you should avoid it at all costs. Can you say that's true or not?
As far as I know, that's not true. I mean, CSS Hover works fine in all browsers, even in all mobile browsers. A mobile browser may not support Hover, but if it does, it works fine and immediately.
Because it seemed to me odd that something that the browser does natively to me, that when I simulate it with an event handler and a style change in JavaScript, should be faster than something the browser does automatically.
Yeah, I agree with you. It shouldn't be faster. I guess it's slower. I've never found any problem with Hover, except for certain mobile browsers just not supporting it at all.
And Opera 7 not showing rendered elements when you show them. Fully, I had that. Menus showed up halfway through and these kind of things.
Oh, right. I can't remember that. But it was Opera 7, so they've improved meanwhile.
Well, now we're talking shop here. It's like, it's great that we test for all these things. It's great we find all these solutions. But does the market really, really upgrade as often as we want it to? And what can we do about this?
That's a good question. Obviously, we web developers all want a greater adoption speed and stuff like that. But basically, I think it's going fairly well. I mean, what was the last time that a browser implemented something that was violently opposed to the standards? I mean, we have to go back to IE 5.5 or 6 or something. So in terms of standards compliance, browsers are definitely converging. In terms of performance, browsers are definitely converging, and basically the only real worry we're having right now is IE6 on desktop. I mean, IE6 is a huge problem, and as far as I'm concerned, it's not going away anytime soon because of corporate intranets whose applications work only with IE6.
Well, let's also not forget that people that implement IE6 in companies went for a training course once 5 years ago to be the IT guy, and showing people that there's new stuff would prove that they haven't done anything in the last 5 years to improve themselves.
True.
And then there's the problem with pirated Windows not being able to upgrade.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge problem. And basically, it's all about professionalization. The people who implemented these apps were not front-end professionals. They may have been back-end professionals, I wouldn't know, but they were not front-end professionals. And that brings us all back to the whole professionalization issue. People who pretend to be front-enders need to be aware of new developments in the browser market, new developments in the JavaScript libraries, etc., etc. And that takes a lot of time and calls for a certain specialization. And I hope that, Yahoo is doing wonderful work in that regard, of course, and I hope that that specialization will eventually become normal and that everybody will just say, oh, we need a good front-end, then we will hire a good front-ender.
Another scary thing about this is every time I talk to other people that are in our markets and do these kind of things, they come up with, I come up with the argument like, it's now time to reach those corporates. It's now time to go and change room booking systems, change flight status systems, change banking systems. But every time the answer that I get is like, yeah, we won't reach these guys anyway, so why do we bother? I think we should bother because we've been telling each other long enough that our stuff is cool rather than like, what do people have to use and what costs them 2 hours of their lives every day?
True. I completely agree. We cannot, as far as I'm concerned, reach those corporate developers directly. But what we can do is work through Microsoft and Adobe. And that's something I've been thinking about for a while. Basically, both Microsoft and Adobe have huge development outreach programs and stuff like that. And they're also willing to consider web standards. They're pretty important for the IE team and for the Dreamweaver team. So why not work through Microsoft and Adobe channels to reach those developers? Still, we won't reach all of them, but we will reach a significant portion of them.
I'm getting a bit of a mixed messages from both these companies. I know people in both these companies, and I know the people that are on our end and say, like, yeah, let's fix the web and let's make it. And Pete Lepage, wonderful guy. Several guys in the Adobe world here in England are great. But I always find that they do a talk about something like us, and the next talk that I see is by some sales guy saying exactly the opposite. I mean, we have the same problem in companies like here, but what can we do about this?
Basically, go to developers' conference. Try to cut the salespeople out of the loop entirely. I recently gave a small talk at a local Microsoft conference in Holland, which shows that people are interested by what you have to say. I'm not totally sure about the exact makeup of my audience there, but it turns out that most people were actually interested in what I talked about, web standards, you know, and separate your CSS from your HTML, and it was a new message to some of them. And basically, I was able to reach out to these people who had vaguely heard about web standards but didn't really know what it was about. And I was able to reach out to them through Microsoft, because I talked to a local guy at Microsoft and said, okay, let's try it, let's give a talk. And I think we web developers should do that more often. I mean, I mention Microsoft and Adobe because they're the most obvious examples, but I think there will be more companies that are interested in stuff like this.
IBM, BioWebLogic, Accenture, these kind
whatever,
of people.
Whatever, yeah, sure, why not?
It's quite the same that I'm doing right here at the moment, because there's not any conference lined up for the next week, which is quite an uncommon thing this year. So I'm doing brown bags. So basically I'm going to companies and say, like, I can come during lunch break and give you a talk about a topic that you want me to talk about, which could be web standards, which could be YQL, which could be performance, whatever. I basically give them a catalog of what I can talk about. And that's a great concept, because I reach developers that I've never reached before. And you find all these people that we thought are just mythical that still use table layouts because they make more sense to them.
Yeah.
It's really hard for them to understand, like, oh my God, everything we've done the last 4 years is already outdated 8 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's what I also saw at that Microsoft conference. After my speech was done, somebody came up to me and talked about the discussion about using CSS instead of tables. And I thought, yeah, oh my God, there we go again. But of course, I stayed calm and cool and in control, and I told them, yes, I think that CSS would be the better way because of, well, you know, all the arguments. But it still shows that they are just 8 to 10 years behind in their development, in their technical development. And that's something we as web developers will have to change, because we have the knowledge, they don't. And your brown bag concept is pretty interesting. The only thing is getting into the companies. I mean, that's much easier when you work for Yahoo than when you work for, say, a small web agency or something like that. So basically, everybody should try something and work through whatever contacts you have just to be able to speak for an hour with people who actually implement front ends without being professional front enders.
One thing I realized with that is that people saw me speaking at other conferences or had my book, and then basically when they followed me on Twitter and I said, hey, I can come to lunch break, then they started talking to me. It's not necessarily it was Yahoo, it was just I was visible on the web.
Okay.
And there are so many unsung heroes at the moment. I mean, Ara Pelavian, for example, he does really good work, and he wrote his JavaScript book and everything, but nobody knows about him yet. I think we have to start opening up our, like, superhero speaker cast a bit more, because right now there's a lot of people saying the same things over and over again. A lot of people that have the chance don't get a chance to actually speak
at web developer conferences, but they might get a chance to speak at the companies you were talking about earlier, who just want to know about web development in general. First of all, that's of course an excellent excellent test case for being able to speak in front of an audience for people. Secondly, I think that the fact that we get little new speakers this year mostly has to do with the recession. All the conference organizers are playing on safe. I'm doing that myself too for the Frontiers conference that I'm organizing in Amsterdam. Right now, I prefer well-known speakers, because they will more easily attract attendees. And that's a problem, I think, only for this year. And I hope to be able to do some more experimenting next year to be able to get some new unknown speakers. But right now, it's just the economy.
It's an interesting fact that a lot of times people just go for names, but that's partly because they don't know it. So maybe a new approach would be to start a conference half a year earlier as a portal or as a wiki and introduce different speakers and make the audience vote who they want to see.
Would be an interesting idea. Yeah, sure, let's try it. It's just that you cannot be sure that somebody who votes on the wiki will also pay for a ticket.
Or is the person that actually, because people that go to conference aren't necessarily the ones that follow everything that's going on the web.
Exactly, they go to conferences in order to follow stuff that's going on. So it's a tricky subject. Basically, what I think is that from next year on, things will clear up, and conference organizers will start to get new speakers in again. But this year, there's a little chance of it. I'm not quite as negative, I think, as you may be, because the point is also the audience, the traditional audience that always goes to all the web conferences and always likes it, wants to see something new too. So they will start to call for new speakers too in a while, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not doing any criticizing of event organizers here because they have a lot of other things on their hand. I just feel like there are several people that should get more chances to do things.
Yeah, agree.
And even not necessarily if they already have the expertise as a speaker. I mean, for example, look at the area stuff that Steve Faulkner has given, the talks. The presentations weren't amazing. He's not an amazing speaker, but he had so many cool things to say that people were realizing, like, wow, there's a guy who has his stuff together, and send him emails and got more documentation out of him. And I think that's very important as well.
True. You don't have to be a great speaker in order to present an interesting session.
Yeah. Talking of professional environments and development, what are your thoughts on test-driven development?
Then you have to explain test-driven development first.
Okay, let's put that into another talk then.
Yes.
Because it might be a bit longer. It's basically that you write the things that your interface should be doing up front, and then you write the code to do it. So you can always test against the test that you've defined beforehand.
Okay, that's an interesting subject. Let's do that in another talk.
Fair enough. And in terms of debugging on mobile phones...
By accident, I found one JavaScript error message on, I think it was a Nokia 5800, but I have no idea how it came up. I didn't understand the error message, and it was the single error message I ever saw on a mobile phone.
So basically, you have to, when it doesn't work, you're shot.
Yeah, basically, yes. Well, I always turn to Firefox. 9 out of 10 times is actually a pretty simple mistake you've made in your original JavaScript. And the 10th time, it's usually a DOM method that the browser doesn't support. Hmm. So those are easy to work around. But yeah, debugging on mobile is hell.
Did you find a lot of false positives? I remember like old Opera saying they understand document get element by ID, but then they didn't implement document create text node. So if you wanted to test for DOM support, you had to test for both.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find browsers that implement a method, but then don't follow what it's supposed to do?
Not yet, no.
Maybe a sign that browsers are finally getting better.
Yes, I think so. I mean, but Opera back then was heavily criticized for that. I think I even did some of the criticizing back then. Because that's, of course, nonsense. You should either implement the method or you shouldn't. But no, I've not encountered any false positives yet.
Well, it's like Netscape 4 CSS.
Wonderful. Yeah, but let's not talk about Netscape 4, right?
Well, it's quite interesting on the mobile market how we changed from bespoke development for different SDKs and for different operating systems to building web applications for mobile phones. Do you see that market even growing more, or do you see a backlash going back to, like, let's build something for the mobile phone itself so we can take care of, like, accelerometers and fancy things that the mobile phone does?
Well, first of all, we will be getting device APIs, which means that via JavaScript you can directly plug into the accelerometer, the geolocation, the camera, the address book, etc., etc. There are security issues involved, by the way. I mean,
I was about to say that.
Yes, it's not at all secure at the moment, but the point is these security issues will probably be solvable. And once we have safe device APIs, we can actually build mobile applications in the browser or in a widget environment or whatever, any environment that supports normal web standards. So yes, I definitely see the mobile market growing hugely. It's just that now we have to take quite a few steps. Certain browsers have to become much better. Safe device APIs have to be invented, and we have to have some system of, I'm especially thinking of W3C widgets, which is part of my job at Vodafone to work with them. And basically, W3C widgets have to be supported by more platforms than just the Vodafone phones and any phone with Opera Mobile 9.51 or higher.
Mm-hmm. Can you give a quick overview of what HTML3 widgets mean?
W3C widgets are basically, you create a website, one single HTML page with as many CSS, JavaScript, and image files as you like. You zip them, you change the extension to .wgt, you upload them to the mobile phone, and it works. I forget one thing. You also have to include a config.xml, which is a pretty simple manifest file that says, okay, this is a widget, this is the name, and these are the widths and heights, plus this widget may or may not have network access.
So that's like Blueprint works for Yahoo, but we have an XML syntax instead of just plain HTML.
Yes,
we filter it down to like pre-tested little applications that work already.
Yes, and basically here you just say we use web standards, and we assume that the widget environment is able to handle web standards. And basically, the widget environment right now is Opera, so that's pretty much okay. Still, it should be eventually widget environment should include all mobile browsers and all mobile platforms, as far as I'm concerned.
I remember making about 200 euros, well, at that time 200 Deutschmarks, for about 10 lines of XML that was a web page with a gift like 19 characters per page per deck. That was awesome. Then iMode came around, and now we're going back to we had WML on set-top boxes, and now we're going back to web standards. Is there a chance that the web standard thing will die, and another person comes around with like, why don't we have a Facebook XML for mobile phones?
Frankly, I don't think so, because web standards are already there. Web standards are in practice implemented by every single mobile browser there is right now, any single modern mobile browser. Even the so-called bad browsers do web standards. It has an enormous push right now. Everybody is doing web standards on the desktop, and it will be relatively easy to introduce those people to mobile web development. Besides, suppose somebody comes around with a new idea, let's make applications in my proprietary language. Okay, sure, fine, it'll work on one phone, but why would the other phones agree with having it work on their platform too? I mean, what's the point if they already have web standards? And if plenty of web developers who already know web standards can start working on mobile applications? That's the most important part of widgets and of the mobile platform in general. If you are a web developer, if you know your CSS and JavaScript, you will have to learn a lot of tiny details about the mobile browsers. But once you understand them, you can just start building stuff.